Good afternoon. We'd like to welcome everyone to this afternoon's study session for the Mesa City Council, Monday, September 12th, 2011. We'd like to excuse Councilmember Glover, who is going to be here a little bit later. He had another obligation that he couldn't get out of. First item on the agenda is to review the items for tonight's regular council meeting. Again, on page 2, items 3A and 3B. 4A through 4D. Five A through six A. Mr. Brady.
Mayor, Council. We have just a quick presentation for 5F, a fairly significant item here. I think we want to just share with you a few slides. And Mr. Butler, can you do that quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Mayor, Council, Mr. Brady, appreciate that. Just wanted to pause for a moment as we approve the resolution authorizing the $77 million in HPAN sales on State Route 24.
HPAN, excuse me?
The Highway Project Advancement Notes, which...
pause at your quarter on the way out of it,
yeah,
please.
Absolutely, yes, sir. To celebrate a little success on this, it's actually January, the upcoming January represents 6 years that the city's been working on this project to try to accelerate State Route 24 for all that it means for Southeast Mesa.
So you've been working 6 years so you can accelerate it.
That's right.
Okay, that's good.
Sometimes that's just the way government works.
As you know. That is a
that's
perfect idea
speed.
About government.
That's lightning speed.
Absolutely.
You spend 6 years to do something faster. I like that.
I know. It's gone through a lot of versions, Mayor. We've been appropriated money from the state legislature. We've had that money rescinded. Then we've been appropriated again, all in an attempt to further this freeway for economic development purposes and to take advantage of the environment that we're in right now where infrastructure development couldn't come into better time, both for job creation but also for furthering some of the development that we're looking at on the eastern side of the airport and other areas. So just very briefly, on the slide that's in front of you about the right-of-way, about the cost of the project overall through the different versions, when the Prop 400 was approved by the voters, the estimate at the time was that the freeway would cost approximately $217 million. In 2008, MAG updated those numbers using the current right-of-way cost and bid structure, and it dropped down to $193 million. But today, we're happy to report that the final numbers that we're looking at, now these could change somewhat because they haven't actually bid the project yet. After the council authorizes the sale of the HPAN's Highway Project Advancement Notes again this evening, and those are deposited into ADOT's account, they will advertise and bid this project. But the way the bid structure is coming in right now, we believe the project overall will cost $122 million, which is almost half of what the estimates were back when Prop 400 were approved. So by advancing this project, we've really done a great service to the region and to the taxpayers by bringing down the cost of this project.
Well, if you could stay on that slide, because I think, you know, the original estimate, you know, those were just sort of reach out of the air. But the 2008 is, to me, is significant, especially when the right-of-way acquisition, just by being able to advance this, what you're saying is, that's almost $12 million in just flat-out savings by doing it now when the economy is soft and we have opportunities that we would not have otherwise. So I think that's pretty significant. Then, of course, you look at the construction, which is almost $60 million, $57 million. Mm-hmm. That's just extraordinary. So,
Mayor, keep in mind, this project is originally scheduled 2016.
2016.
Mm-hmm. So... yeah, we're showing you the comparison 2008 and today, but if we were not to advance and go through the normal schedule, then
who knows?
I don't know where it'd be, but it could be higher. I'm not sure if we. Hopefully, we're not going to. I mean, it may get a little bit lower. We suspect it could get a little higher. So, again, the other part is what I look at this is at one point we had budgeted over $20 million the city was willing to put up to do the advancement today. Actually, we're giving money back, if you would, to the region because of the city's willingness to move forward. But at the end of the day, I don't know if you're going to pull this out, is when one of the reasons, the motivations to do this project, we didn't really, as good as we are, we really didn't know that the cost of construction was going to go down that far, or even the cost to finance was going to be as inexpensive as it is. We are doing this, and this is our primary motivation even today, is it opens up a huge opportunity for economic development in Mesa around the airport. And that, for us, is a huge number that even back when we were talking about $20 million, we could justify it. Today, now we're talking about actually saving money for the region overall and advancing the opportunity for infrastructure to open up economic development in Mesa. So it's a great story for all of us.
Vice Mayor.
Scott, a simple question. I read recently, Moody's just downgraded transportation bonds for the state because they're not transferring money. The system is not as stable as it used to be. How might or will that affect our HPANs?
I'm sorry, council members. We just received our ratings from both Standard & Poor's and from Moody's, and we've been reaffirmed on both of those.
Well,
first of all, say the difference between the state transportation and this. This is not a state transportation funded. It's regional monies, right?
Right.
And so explain that why those would be different, this project would be different than the overall highway ADOT type
Sure. Department Mayor and Vice Mayor, the reason that the warning was put out for Moody's, and I believe just Moody's at this point to the state, was the continuous raids of the HERF highway user revenue funds that we've talked about many times. Unfortunately, that the state continues to sweep those funds to use for other purposes besides highway construction. That has sent a ripple effect now year after year as those monies have been diverted. Now it's starting to come back as the rating agencies are looking at that and questioning the long-term stability of the state highway program and the ability of ADOT to be able to provide for the products that the projects that are in the program.
And they did that because they were satisfied there were no gimmicks being used to balance state budget, right? Yeah, okay.
Right, exactly.
That would be a no.
Yeah.
Okay, but just to be civil, there's a difference between
Absolutely.
What this project is. We don't anticipate any additional risk because of the state's reduction in the Moody's rate.
Different pool of money.
Different pool of money, right. Okay.
These are dedicated funds that the state actually can't sweep because they're regional funds that are collected for purpose, which is the Prop 400.
Right. And that's what I wanted to make sure that was the case. Thank you, John.
Mayor and Vice Mayor, to that point as well, the second slide and really the last one we'll leave you with today talks about the fact of, as Mr. Brady talked about, the amount of money that the City of Mesa presented to council when we came and received authorization to move forward with this project. We were at that point estimating somewhere around $19.8 million that the city would need to come up with to accelerate this project. There were some other monies we were hoping to get through the statewide transportation acceleration needs account, STAN monies at the time, but that was uncertain. The situation down at the state capitol made that money questionable, but we still believed and council believed in the importance of getting this freeway going as soon as possible, and we were at that point willing and authorized to spend somewhere around $20 million in city funds in order to advance that. We're also happy to report that now, since the overall cost of the project has come down, thus leading to a lower financing cost of the project, and the fact that we went out and found $18 million in other resources that could be used to pay the interest expense. As it stands today, assuming we don't have any dramatic changes when our bids open, which we're not expecting, the City of Mesa will be on the hook for $0 out of this advancement. So that's really good news that we were able to do that and not have to tap into those funds that we'd set aside to advance the project.
Councilman Richens?
If the estimates come back a little bit higher than what we're seeing here, is there a possibility that we will have to pay any of that interest, or will we on the hook for any of those costs? And what's the threshold? Do you know what the threshold might be?
Yeah, anything right now, Mayor and Councilmember Richens, anything over $18 million in interest cost would be split 50-50 per our agreement between the Maricopa Association of Governments and the city. So at first, we were expecting that the city would pay $20 million and MAG would pay $20 million. Right now, it'll be anything over $18 million will be split between the two entities. And as it stands today, our financing costs are estimated to be about $16.7 million on the project. We have $18 million, so we even have more money today set aside than we'll actually need. So we're hopeful because the construction costs were based on new bid estimates that were just opened 2 weeks ago because there's a new project on the Loop 303 in the West Valley that was just unsealed, and the bids were taken into account in coming up with the final estimate that we're using before we issue the HPANs.
So you think it's a pretty good guess?
We think it's a very good
guess. How much over $122 million would we have to go before we start seeing interest costs? Do you know?
It's
Councilmember Richens, that's a sliding scale. You've got interest rates because we haven't obviously gone to market yet. We've got a lot of variables that haven't been, but we do have $1.3 million in variable play.
Yeah, the good news is all indicators are working to our favor. We have a recent bid on the construction costs. Those costs have been pretty flat, if not declining, as long as commodity prices hold. And then really on the market side, this is a good time to be in the market for capital. So with between Chuck and Larry and his folks structuring the sell these bonds, we believe we'll be in a very competitive position as far as the borrowing cost. So we're optimistic that that cushion will be sufficient. But again, we've already budgeted in our capital program that $20 million. I mean, if we have to tap into it, it'll be at least from what we're projecting right now, it'll be a very small amount.
Okay. Thank you, Councilmember Finter.
I just wanted to say I appreciate Mr. Brady's comments, because what I see this is jobs. And if the message isn't getting out there, we are looking to get 100,000 good-paying jobs in that gateway area, and we have to make this investment. And so I know some folks will look at this and go, wow, that's a tremendous amount of money. But when it costs us virtually zero interest, and we're able to accelerate economic development, which is jobs, I think that's what citizens of Mesa really appreciate hearing. So I appreciate the work that's been done here, Mr. Brady. Thank you.
Thank you. And just another kind of maybe quick thing to say. The city of Mesa is accelerating dollars, regional dollars, that are designated for Mesa in a project that's further out into the future. We are now going forward and accelerating that project earlier on. And by so doing, by the city willing to stand up and put this project out there, the project's going to be done at a perfect time for proper capital projects, low cost of construction and low cost of borrowing. So for the region and for Mesa, as you said, we're delivering a project much earlier, creates that benefit for jobs, and it creates savings to the region overall.
And, you know, the 202, what was the original timeline on the 202 completion? About right now?
About right now, yes, Mayor, when the original Loop 202 finish dates were.
And we accelerated that, and the economic development, like Councilman Finner was saying, has far outweighed. Allegiant wouldn't be flying in, First Solar wouldn't have gone.
Right.
And none of those things would have happened without 202 being completed. So that's a real example. That's a real-life example of what happens when you, first of all, invest in infrastructure, and secondly, you do it as quickly as you can, because it starts the economic engine running, which I hope, I don't have a whole lot of hope, but it would be nice if Washington could see that, and the investment in infrastructure is getting such a bad name that it's disheartening to see where you have real investments that have real economic returns that, guess what, help us get out of deficits, things like that, that are now being used as political fodder, which is unfortunate. And end of my editorializing.
Mayor, and I'll just add, we've already started to see the fruits of this labor already. Now, because we have 100% design, the Gateway Airport Authority has already been able to use the certainty of where the freeway alignment is going to go to start planning for the East Side Terminal expansion. And that's been a tremendous asset for them as they plan ingress and egress out of the terminal, knowing what kind of state infrastructure, like the SR-24, where it will be, when it will be included. It's been a tremendous asset for that planning that's occurring today. So.
Great. Thank you. Any more questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Items, page 5, items 6B through 8B. Councilmember Cavanaugh.
Just to comment on item 6B, this is an introduction, but it's a really important introduction. As Councilmember Finter said, it's really all about jobs, and this is a council use permit to basically double the size of a semiconductor business that has been providing good jobs in Mesa, over 130 jobs at near Country Club and Baseline for the past 16 years. And this is going to allow up to an additional 120 high-paid jobs at this facility. And I know that our city's economic development staff and planning staff has worked with International Rectifier really over the last year to help make this happen. And I appreciate all the work that staff has done on this important project. Thank you.
Thank you. And a good example is, you know, we talk about bringing in new business, and that's always sexy, but one of the main focuses of our economic development is to take care of existing businesses so they can add jobs. And they have worked diligently with International Rectifier, so thank you for bringing that up. Okay? All right. Now let's go to the study session agenda. We're going to do a couple of changes to this agenda. We will take item 2A and hear that now. Then we will move on to item 2C, move into executive session, and then come back for 2B. We want to make sure we have time for all of those and don't want to get backed up. So we're on a pretty tight time frame here. It's now about 10 minutes before 4, and we have a council meeting that starts at 5:45. So we'll now go item 2A, hear presentation, discuss 2012 employee benefits program. Mr. Manning.
Good afternoon, Mayor Smith, members of council. I'm Gary Manning with Human Resources, and with me today is Margie Ward, our benefits administrator, and of course, all of you know Candace, our budget director. We'll make this very brief because we know we're short on time. What we wanted to do this afternoon is give you a very quick overview of what we anticipate the 2012 employee benefits program will look like. As you will recall, last year in September of 2010, we gave you a presentation that included some particular challenges. We were having fiscal challenges in meeting the rising expenditures that we had in medical costs. And we said we'd come back to you after we had designed some goals and some ways to better manage those costs, as well as always be ever mindful of the increased premiums and the impact that those premiums would have for our employees. I am happy to report to you that this year there has been a significant decrease in medical expenditures, and we'll talk to you in a minute about that. I just wanted to remind you about what type of insurance programs we offer to employees. We do have four medical plans, three dental plans, two vision plans, and we do offer life insurance through the Cigna Group. Those plans are all funded primarily in three ways. One is contributions from the city. The other is combined contributions for employees. And the third is some money we receive back from the Arizona State Retirement System in the form of a subsidy as a result of employees who retire from the city of Mesa but choose to stay on our medical plan rather than go on the Arizona State Retirement System. As I said last year when we came to you with some significant fiscal challenges, we identified several goals that we had. First was we needed to establish a city contribution philosophy that was really based on determining the amount that the city would contribute towards each one of the plans, the same amount. What we decided that we wanted to do was take the benchmark plan, which is our choice plan 80-20 plan, and we said whatever forecasted costs we had in that plan, we would take 80% of those forecasted costs, and whatever dollar amount that was going to be the consistent dollar amount based on plan and based on coverage level that the city would contribute to all employees. As you'll recall, last year, even though it looked like for the last several years that the city was contributing the same amount to all employees on their plan, in reality, when we looked at the total cost, that wasn't happening. So that was one of the first goals that we had, was to come up with a contribution philosophy that provided the same consistent level across the board at the 80% level of that benchmark plan. Having done that, that really accomplishes goal two, which is to make sure that all employees receive a consistent level, a consistent amount of contribution from the city. We also said that in order to come up with that consistent contribution level, it was probably going to take us a little bit of time. We knew that if we tried to implement that model in January of this year, premiums would go up pretty high for employees. We knew we couldn't do that, so we came to you and said we're probably looking at a three-year phase-in implementation approach. And certainly employees last year were told that as we move towards that goal of having that contribution philosophy and that consistent amount, then employees really needed to expect premium increases for probably the next 3 years. Here's some good news in terms of medical costs. Last September, we forecasted that healthcare costs for this year in 2011 would rise by probably 10.8%. Well, based on our own cost-saving strategies and claims experience and national trends, we're actually forecasting an 8.5 increase in medical costs for 2012, and that is really good news for employees and for the city. So combined with the premium increases and cost savings we've achieved, we've actually achieved the goal of reaching that 80% consistent level 1 year early. We've able to shave off 1 year on that. As a result of that, as you will see, we've got some slides that we can show you on what the premiums will be. About half of the employees will see no premium increases or increases that we forecasted, increases that were scheduled. The other half will see slightly higher monthly increases of about either $4 a month or $9 a month more, depending on the plan and what the coverage level is. This slide really is just a graphical representation about how medical costs have been able to be contained based on some very aggressive cost containment strategies that the benefits office under Margie's leadership has been able to put into play. This graph shows you that the top two lines, the dotted purple line represents last September when we came to you, what we anticipated the forecasted medical expenditures would be. The solid green line represents what they are today and the revised forecast. That gap in between those two lines represents some fairly significant savings to the city as a result of these cost containment measures. The bottom two lines represent the similar graph, but for our retirees. In terms of just some examples of cost-saving strategies that the benefits office has put into play, over on the top right, you've got an example that probably the biggest cost savings that we're going to see comes in terms of a competitive bid contract that we put out for our pharmacy benefit manager. We have Medco today. We are going to be going with a different carrier. And we anticipate that ongoing savings just in that competitive bid process alone is going to save the city about $2.7 million. We are also going to replace our out-of-area network contract, which we think will net us about $200,000. And we're replacing the contract for our employee assistance program, which should bring us about $6,800. We're also, for the first time this year, going to be implementing what's called an allowable cost model for out-of-network claims. And that really just applies to anybody who goes out-of-network instead of to a Blue Cross Blue Shield provider. If they choose to go to an out-of-network provider, we're going to contain that cost and only pay what industry standard considers to be reasonable, which we've never done before. That really should net us about another $200,000. And just another example, we're going to clarify chiropractic visits that right now the plan identifies that employees only have 25 visits to a chiropractor. We're going to make sure that those are coded properly as manipulations rather than office visits, which some chiropractors are doing. Those are just some examples of some of the important cost savings measures that we've been able to put into place that has really reduced those medical expenditures significantly. This graph really just identifies for you the blue is the forecasted member contributions that are going up slightly. The green is the forecasted city contributions that are going up. And the solid blue line at the top just simply represents what we forecast our expenses to be. And really all that graph shows you is that our revenue is in fact going to be meeting our expenses, which is a good thing. This is a slide that really identifies what the premium contributions will be for next year. As I said, about half of the employees will see either no increases or increases that were anticipated. The yellow that you see there on the slide really identify employees that will see increases that are slightly higher than the increases we forecasted to them last year. So, for example, on the Choice PPO plan, single coverage, we anticipated that increases would go up from 61 really to less than 96, and it's going up to about $96, which represents about a $9 more per month increase than what we had previously forecasted. Also down on the copay choice plan family, we estimate that on that one that employees on that plan are going to be paying about $4 more per month than what was previously estimated. With this plan, when we look at same monthly medical premiums for retirees, similar approach, that the yellow represents retirees on the copay family plan who are going to be paying slightly higher more per month than what we had anticipated. And when you do the math, that comes out to about $61 per month. In terms of coverage highlights, really no change to deductibles, coinsurance, or copays. No change to out-of-pocket maximums. Medical out-of-network services are going to be subject to allowable costs, which I said will be the first time that we've done that this year. In terms of dental plan, again, no changes to deductibles, coinsurances, or maximums. With our vision plan, we were at one time going to tell you that no changes to it, but really as a result of some contract renegotiation, it is going to go up slightly, but really only about $1 per month more. It's what anybody could expect who were on that vision plan. Another kind of an exciting opportunity, for the first time, we are going to be implementing a 24/7 nurse hotline. What that means is employees, wherever you are, whether it's on the weekend, whether it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you have a child with a 102 temperature, pick up the phone. There will be a 24/7 nurse hotline so they can call a qualified medical professional and can kind of walk them through that anxious period of time. We think that really is going to save us some dollars in the end by encouraging people maybe not to have to go to the emergency room when they really didn't have to, but also give them just that added assurance that just a phone call away and they'll be able to contact a qualified medical professional. So we really think our employees will appreciate and like that. The next two slides, really I'll turn over to Candace from a budget perspective.
Gary mentioned some of the savings that we're going to accomplish this year through the savings through the expenses on the medical plans. And just to put that in perspective, for the 11-12 fiscal year budget, so the budget that we're in today, we had originally budgeted $54.8 million total contributions to our employee benefit trust fund. Of that, $46.5 million was for the medical portion of those plans. So that was the budget for this fiscal year. Just go to the next one. When we go back and through the decreased expenses that we have, we look at a revised city contribution that we'll need for this fiscal year will be $39.6 million. That is a budget savings of $6.9 million to the 11-12 fiscal year. So that's for this fiscal year. Those savings will begin in January when the new plans go into effect. So that's with the 2012 medical plans. The general fund portion of that is about 71%. So about 71% of all of the city's contributions to the medical plans is on behalf of general funded employees. Okay. So what does that mean for us? What we'd like to do is we'd really like to, these are savings to the personal services portion of our budget. Okay. These are, and this budget was forecast as part of our forecast last fall when we came to you. What we'd like to do is come back to you a month from now and take a look at what we reallocating these savings to another portion of our personal services budget, another portion of compensation that stays, keeps it within the personal services portion of our budget. So we wanted to come to you today and kind of look at these savings, make you aware that this is what we're working on, and that with this implementation of these particular rates, that will allow us to come back to you next month to discuss some options on some compensation options that we could possibly do as a mid-year rather than waiting until the 12-13 fiscal year.
Okay. Any questions? Councilmember Higgins.
This is actually for Gary. Back on page 8 where we show the different plans.
Yes.
We just have single and family. Have we ever looked at a more tiered approach to where we'd have employee and spouse, employee, single employee, single child, that type of thing, to break that up a little bit more?
Yes, Councilmember Higgins. That request has come up on a number of occasions about why we don't tier the plans a little bit more than we do with just simply single and family. And if you'd like, we could certainly do some research for you and come back with some information on what a tiered approach might look like and what those rates would look like. We'd be happy to do that for you.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Vice Mayor.
Gary, on slide 9, monthly premiums, 2012 retirees. The math isn't working for me. The totals, when you take the city and retiree account, the totals don't add up. For example, take Choice Plus Plan 9010 under family, it's 1745 total. Mm-hmm. That's a city of 1,001, retiree 1484. Math was not my major, but that's not 1745. And that goes across the whole thing. Slide 8 seems to add up fairly well. What am I missing? There's something on the bottom?
Yeah. Offset.
So what's the family offset?
That's that retirement system subsidy that we get.
Can I borrow your glasses?
Absolutely.
I've
for employees on single coverage, we get about $150 a month. For family coverage, it's more like $260 a month.
Okay, so
those savings offset the amount that employees have to pay based on those rates.
The retirement, that's the missing piece.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Retirement system subsidy.
I missed that somewhere. Thanks.
Yes, you bet.
Councilmember Finter.
Just wanted to express appreciation. I know that staff and you particularly have really gone out and challenged the system. And you heard that from council saying, please go back and look at this, and done an amazing job. Great savings there. The innovation of having the 24-hour call service, you know, and folks, you know, maybe it's a situation that doesn't have to go to the most expensive portion of an ER visit. I heard about a city employee that went through and just a huge bill that probably could have been handled a little differently. And so, and then also to the employees about reducing the usage, that'll be a great case study someday to look at what we've been through these last few years and how it impacted this system. So just really appreciate all the good work that's done there and just huge savings. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Councilmember Finter, appreciate that. And really all of that goes to Margie in the benefits office. She's done a terrific job there. Really just the last slide that we had for you is to let you know that October 24th through November 4th is our open enrollment. And this year we're going to do something a little bit different. We're looking at more of a passive enrollment rather than an active enrollment. And really what that means is the only employees that will have to participate in enrollment are those that would like to change something on it. So first time we've done that in a whole lot of years, and we think that will be less administrative burden on a lot of people, so we're going to do that. The benefits fair is October 26th, and that's really just a one-day event where employees come and really get immersed in what their benefits are all about, some good benefit education, and we're going to invite some vendors and some wellness booths, and should be a good time for everybody.
But Gary, your point though is that this enrollment, the figures we've seen today, that's what the employees are going to see. They'll start that enrollment on between October 24th and November 4th. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's when the enrollment will be, with an effective date of January 1.
Yeah, and on that one slide it says savings to begin to be realized on January 1st.
That's actually
they begin on January.
Yes.
It's savings throughout the year, but that's when they kick in.
Yeah.
They don't all show up at the same time.
No, it'll spread out over that. Yeah.
Okay. You know, I'm anxious to see when you come back in the next month, and hopefully we'll have some more updated information from sales tax collections, things like that, that we can also plug into that overall analysis of where we are. But this is a great start.
Right. And next month that'll allow us to have one quarter done for the 11-12 fiscal year on our other revenue streams as well.
And, you know, if things hold or if they improve at all, which I hope they can do, but we won't know until we see, then we have some flexibility. And that's this is money found, so thank you. And we, you know, really with minimal impact and even some increases in service levels, so that's
right.
Especially, we haven't cut and slashed.
No.
And that's one thing, I'd just like to say that's one thing I really appreciate of the staff and this council, is that as we've made reductions, and they haven't been easy, you know, you have people involved, but I think the approach has always been a measured approach, and it's always been one that really focuses on not simply cutting. You know, that's where I think Washington could really learn. God, here I am editorializing again. Can't help myself. But, I mean, they really have been a thoughtful approach. And we look at HPAN. You know, I mean, in the normal sense, we would have never built this because you can't build things right now. It costs money. And yet we saw over $50 million in real improvements or savings plus the added economic development. Here you've approached something, I think, in a very measured, respectful way and have accomplished a great deal. So thank you, because that helps us. That hopefully helps us to do some things in other areas, especially with our employees, that will help us going forward, because you know they have contributed a great deal to where we are now, and they've borne in many cases the brunt of the reductions. So,
and Mayor, just quickly, that savings is realized for a lot of good reasons that you know Gary and his staff have worked hard to get us very competitive rates, but the employees are paying more for health benefits, and they're managing their utilization. So the employees, there's a lot of contribution by the employees in getting to this number also.
Great.
So
okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next item, as we said, item 2C, hear presentation, discuss, provide direction on Chicago Cubs spring training and Riverview Park projects. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor, what I'd like to do is have Mr. Rigby go forward first and kind of provide an overview of the agreements that are being negotiated with the Chicago Cubs, kind of give us a standing of where we are today, an outline. And then as soon as he's done, if we could then have Mark and Wendell and others come forward, and Beth come forward and do a quick presentation of kind of, we want to give you the kind of technical, the written documents, but we also want to begin showing you kind of the layout and the schematics, the concepts that are being discussed today regarding the improvements around Riverview Park. Scott?
Good afternoon, Mayor, Council, Mr. Brady. Yeah, as we talked about, this is to do a brief overview of the three agreements that we've been working on since November. Just a quick background, long history with the Cubs, been very successful at Hohokam and Fitch. We hope to extend that to the next 50 years. As you know, in November 2010, voters approved us moving forward with this project. There are three documents that will govern the spring training development that will occur down at Riverview, what we'll show you here in a minute. The three documents are a development agreement. We'll go into a little bit more detail about this agreement. This is the master agreement that delineates all aspects of the project from design, construction, operation, and funding. Then we'll talk briefly about the facilities use agreement. That is really the heart and soul of this agreement once the facility is constructed. And the last is the option agreement, which is generally tied to what most people call the Wrigleyville West discussion. Project site is the Riverview Golf Course. I kind of outlined the entire site, both with the wastewater treatment plant and the lake and the ball fields up to the northeast. The actual spring training site will be shown here, which is basically everything west of Riverview Drive, which exists today. It does not include Riverview Park or where the current softball field complex sits today. So it's about 96, 97 acres. As you can see, it's at the 101-202 confluence. The basic components of the DA are really in four aspects of it. First is the stadium. The stadium will be fixed and or bermed for approximately 15,000 patrons with potential to expand to 20 if requested, and that will generally be by adding berm seating and 250 improved parking spaces. The team facilities, which is where most of the spring training activity will go on a day-to-day basis, will include a 50,000 square foot clubhouse locker room, a minimum of two major league field practice fields, one minimum practice infield, a minimum of one agility field, 16 batting tunnels and pitching mounds, and a minimum of 150 parking spaces for staff and player personnel. A temporary living quarters for 100 staff members or Cub personnel, and then major league quality lighting for two of those practice fields. For the other component of city fields, this will be a city-owned facility, which will be part of the team that the Cubs can use. It'll be city-owned.
Actually, everything's a city-owned.
You're correct.
Let's make that clear. Everything is city-owned, okay?
Thank you, Mayor. Minimum of four major league size practice fields, 100 parking spaces, lighting, if requested by the Cubs on those city fields, public restroom maintenance concession stand. Now, during spring training, they'll have the opportunity to use those city fields, but after spring training, the city has the ability to program that for city uses, whether recreational or other needs. If the Cubs come asking the city if they could use those city fields, if we do not have a reason to say that we ever had a program, they can use those fields as well.
Yeah, and I know this sounds picky, but I want to make it perfectly clear. We are not building a facility that the Cubs will own. All this is city-owned. The difference in the agreement is that we'll have through the facilities use agreement, part of the facilities that the Cubs will lease from us, and they will have priority or exclusive right to use during the period, like the clubhouse. Okay. Correct. Other areas, such as these four fields, are areas that the city will have joint use of. The Cubs will use those under the agreement during spring training. The city will use those at other times, and then we have some agreements where the Cubs have priority. But I want to be very clear, because you know, there's a misnomer that somehow we are building a facility for the Cubs, and I don't want it to be misunderstood that somehow we're turning the keys over and it's their property. No, it's still our property. And what we're talking about, these are terms of art we're using when we talk city fields. It's primarily
those are non-exclusive use for the Cubs. Those are ones that the city has the right to use, or their shared use facilities, as opposed to like the major league field, which the Cubs under the lease agreement, the rental agreement, has the exclusive right. I mean, is that accurate?
Correct. Absolutely, Mayor.
Yeah, I want to make sure that's clear, because I can just see people the way it's going that we're saying, well, wait, this is different, but it's not. The city owns everything. Okay.
Public parking, game day and stadium events. So this is not only the roughly 16 to 18 spring training games, but also other stadium events. That minimum of 2,500 parking spaces west of the current Riverview Drive. And those parking may be used for grass recreational fields. So it won't be necessarily paid parking. It'll be for other uses during non-game day type activity. The key question always comes up is the financing amount and the way the DA currently is structured. And I want to stress that this is still in negotiations. Any of the three agreements that we're talking about here today, the city will pay up to $84 million for the following improvements.
Okay, I want to clarify. That's not a negotiation. It's a cap. It's $84 million. Okay? It's a cap.
Correct.
Okay. Well, I mean, you said it's still under negotiation. No, $84 million is the amount. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I
think what is included under there is under negotiation.
Correct. That's right.
And that's simply because what is, that's where we're talking with the Cubs and what they're going to pay for and what we're going to pay for, but the amount we're going to pay is $84 million.
Well, we're paying for everything, Mayor, just a reminder again, just what we're going to include in the $84 million cap.
That's right.
And what we're going to include in the $50 million cap.
And if the Cubs want something included in the stadium that goes beyond that, they pay for it.
There you go.
Okay.
Okay. Number one, construction of the stadium, team facilities, and city fields. Public street improvements necessary to access the stadium. Parking. Construction-related taxes, fees, and charges, and on-site utility infrastructure. Now, to your point, Mayor, there is a capital improvement account, and if any funds remain unspent in the 84 after we build these items, those funds will be deposited in an account and will be available for future capital improvements to the facilities. There is an additional city will pay up to $15 million for the following improvements. Public parking, that's at 2,500 parking spaces. Off-site utility infrastructure, and public street improvements. The Cubs' obligations are any costs in excess of $84 million, whether it's a stadium, team facilities, city fields, or other items. Cubs' personnel costs, and the Cubs will provide assistance to the city in backfilling Hohokam Stadium, Fitch Park training facility, and then the key one is number four, is entering into facilities use agreement. Other items are noted in the development agreement is a project committee considering the Cubs and city staff will work together to develop a site plan, project schedule, and project budget, which I think is important to note. We listed several things, such as the stadium being 15,000 seats and possible up to additional five. The project committee will work together to figure out what that final size of that stadium, what the components of that would be.
And that's all, they're working with an $84 million budget.
Correct.
And that's where the priorities are going to be set. And the Cubs will sit down, they'll figure out, okay, if they want to add something else, like go to that, then they get to decide what are we going to give up.
Correct.
Or what are we going to pay for.
Absolutely.
Is that an accurate way to describe
it?
It's
accurate.
Okay.
Another item is signage. The Cubs will have exclusive control of signage within the stadium, and then the Cubs will also submit a comprehensive sign plan for city review and approval. So I know everybody will be interested in the next picture. This is the current conceptual site plan. It is draft. We're still working on this. But to kind of walk through it from west to east is on the far west end, that fourplex is the city fields. That would be the one that the city has the control of all the time, in addition to the spring training where the Cubs can utilize that. To the east of that would be the team facilities where you see the clubhouse. You'll see the three practice fields, the agility fields, the batting mounds, the batting tunnels, and pitching mounds. To the east of that, surrounded in green there, you'll see the actual stadium site. And then you'll see marked in orange is the parking area. And then you'll see a purple designation that, and also the orange can also be what we call the option property, suitable for commercial development. I'll leave the rest of the discussion regarding the park to the next group. But as you can see, we're moving forward and things are starting to get a little bit more finite on how the site is developing. The additional agreements that we're still working on, the facilities use agreement, that stipulates the terms and conditions upon which Mesa will lease the spring training facilities. As I discussed, it's still being negotiated. And some of the items that are included in the what we call the FUA, the facilities use agreement, the terms and duration of the lease, the use and scheduling of the stadium, team facilities, and city fields, operation and maintenance of the facilities. That's a big difference than currently how it works. Revenues, future capital improvements, signage and naming rights. And then the other agreement is the option agreement, which stipulates the terms and conditions tied to the sale or lease or license of city real estate for the commercial development. Next steps, we'll continue to meet with the Cubs. We hope to make substantial movement this week, and then we'll return September 26th for consideration of all three of these agreements, as well as the construction manager at risk, which is actually the construction agreement. Just a note, the staff will be initiating a zoning application to remove some of those development requirements that were stipulated during the Waveyard development agreement. And that's my presentation, if you have questions.
Council Member Higgins.
Thanks, Mayor. I'm just wondering how well tied in the option agreement will be with the development agreement and what, because I don't recall remembering an option agreement. That doesn't mean it wasn't there. So, you know, because we talked about a stadium and Wrigleyville and the whole package and how tied together will those be?
All three agreements are key. Actually, the development agreement is the master agreement, and then once that's entered into, we'll have the facilities agreement and then option agreement. If the city is intending to do the commercial agreement, commercial development, this option agreement is what would govern how that property
gets disposed. Just quickly, what the option agreement does, that the development agreement doesn't do, is that the option agreement lays out the terms by which the Cubs can purchase property from the city for the development of the retail and commercial. And so it defines the value of the land, how much land is available, and their obligations if they are to purchase property, how long they have to develop the property once they purchased it. It'll include to be negotiated the construction requirements, the restriction, the purchase price. So all that will be in the option agreement.
So the development agreement will outline the percent or the square footage of what's open on opening day and that type of thing?
Yeah, the development agreement outlines the development of all of the public facilities. Everything that was listed, the stadium, the fields, the infrastructure, the roads, that's all laid out in the development agreement. What's contemplated that as that is being done, the Cubs will come to the city or already discussing options to bring private development into this larger area. So we had to then create another document that outlined the terms by which they could purchase that property and the guidance for how that property would be developed over time.
So which would include when they have to purchase it,
when,
and what they have to build when.
Yeah.
And if they don't purchase it by a certain time, or if they don't build a certain amount of stuff by a certain time, they lose the right to buy the property. That's what the option.
And other developers,
it gives
them the first option to create that private development, and then it gives them certain time to perform. If they don't perform within that certain period of time, then really it just means the city can invite other developers to come in and sell the property to them. It just gives them that first option, which they'll pay a fee for, to have the right, exclusive right, the first right to develop the property.
So there's no fixed option of what has to be open on opening day.
Yeah.
Yes, there is.
That will be included in the option agreement.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And it's, I think,
because the price for the cost of the option to do private development is you will buy this land by this time and you will develop this building by this time.
Perfect.
And if you don't do that, the penalty, and these are what are being negotiated, is exactly how do you put in the penalty and what exactly goes with that. There will be a penalty, and the penalty is you lose the right to buy the land.
You lose exclusive right to develop,
and then the city can go on and say, okay, you didn't develop it at this time to this standard or whatever terms are included in the option agreement. Therefore, you've lost that right. Now we can either still sell it to you, or we can go on to somebody else who will.
Gives us the option back.
Gives us, we control the land.
Great, thanks.
Okay. Any other questions?
Okay. So quickly, Mark and Beth and Wendell, we just want to, because we're rolling this out, one of the important parts of this, as we've talked about, is as the council, as we're looking at and making this significant investment of the spring training facilities with the stadium and the baseball fields, it's really come to our attention also the need to really focus on Riverview Park. And we have been developing some concepts about how to tie this entire site. Now we're expanding the 96-acre purview to the whole 125-acre perspective. So we just want to quickly show you some concepts that are being looked at. We have plans to go and talk to some communities, leaders, and
so what we're saying is that what we've discussed so far includes the baseball facilities, the private facilities, which will be Wrigleyville, but it has not included the existing Riverview Park. That is not covered by either the development agreement or
that's
the facilities
correct.
Agreement, because that's ours.
City initiative,
and,
but we feel like,
and that's going to stay ours.
And we think that the timing, if we're going to go in there and be grading this property and making significant improvements, it may be an opportunity to look at what's happening in the park. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Brady, Mayor, Council. Just again, a quick overview of the site there that Scott already covered earlier. But again, moving to the next slide, just wanted to point out those program areas, more of looking at them as blocks and the different things that will occur on that site. And for this presentation, we're just going to focus on really A, D, F, and E, but still talk about the connectivity between that entire site and how that works and how we move people through that entire mile of property there. Again, you can see a quick overview of the site. We've gone through a number of concepts. This is the one we've spent a lot of time working on and looking at, but we'll share some of those other concepts that aren't quite as developed as this one with some of the community leaders that Chris mentioned and go from there and see what kind of feedback we get on those before, obviously, any decisions are made. Focusing on the city fields. Again, those are as the mayor alluded to, those are the fields that will be joint use between the city and the Cubs. 200 spaces, the city will use those 200 parking spaces, and then access along 8th Avenue will be another entry, and 8th Street will be another entranceway for pedestrians also, and the city will use these for recreation programming outside of the spring training window. The multi-use space, this is back to the D area, the public parking and soccer fields. In the early stages of the life of this project, we anticipate being able to put 6 full-size soccer fields in this space. And then, again, using that multi-use corridor, that urban corridor, as one of those connectivity points to bring people into the site, as well as seeing some commercial activity throughout there.
Do you have a slide that shows potential build-out on Wrigleyville?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Because I think we need to be careful that this is not anticipated to be the final
correct. We'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Early stages. Again, the existing softball quad will remain early on until a suitable development comes along. We are looking at relocating that parking and doing some road realignment, so we'll have to look at reconfiguring the entrance to the west for the softball quad now. So that we will have to look at doing that to accommodate that parking and the road realignment. And again, touching on the concepts now to reinvest in Riverview Park and making sure that we focus on some of those existing popular amenities such as the fishing, the children's play areas, the picnic ramadas and open play areas, while also trying to look at additional opportunities, whether it's high adventure play, more connectivity and paths and walkways, more shade throughout the site, and trying to look at how we can really enhance this park and reinvest in this location.
So, Mark, probably the most significant thing there is we're moving the lake west towards Riverview, so it create a connection between the spring training facilities and the stadium with the park. Today, that lake is much further back in the corner towards Dobson and 8th. The thinking is that this will become a central area of activity in the park as it is today, but also creating that connection as moving that lake further, much further west, obviously, to the edge of, I think that's Riverview Drive, the road that goes north and south there, so that it really creates a strong connection of activity between the stadium and the park, and it really opens it up for the general public's use.
So it begs the question, why are we doing any change at the Riverview Park? Couldn't we just leave it alone? That's a soft one, so don't whiff it.
When you're looking at investing the type of money that the city is investing, you want this to be a showcase property. This is the entryway to the city. This is going to be a point of pride for years and years to come. Some of the things would need to be addressed within the park, regardless of what happened, from traffic flow to the water within the lake, and the lining there continues to erode. So there would be some natural things.
30 plus years.
Yeah. So that's the primary water source for this project as well. So you need to look at how you address those in terms of piping and how do you turn the pumps to water all the different areas and different facets.
And I think
of this
people,
as well.
I know it's foreign because when we have our own sprinkling system in our house, we just hook it into the existing water system, and you don't do that in large projects. You have a holding facility, either tanks or lakes or whatever, and a lot of times on golf courses and in parks, that serves as the holding facility that serves the water, and then there are pumps that pump out of that lake, and that's what is used to irrigate the trees and the grass. Is that
correct?
The same thing that's going on here?
Correct.
Okay. Vice Mayor?
Simple question. How are we paying for this? It's not part of the $84 million. Is it part of the $15 million infrastructure?
We would think that most of this could come out of the 15, although yes, that is correct. And now some of that, most of the development would be part of the 15, and there would be some part because of the lake contributing to the, as the mayor was just talking about, the irrigation system would be covered in the 84. The reality is this park is in need of a significant realignment and facelift, and so whether all of this will be funded from the $15 million and whether we'll have to lay out a large master plan with some of the amenities, and some of those amenities may have to be designed in concept but maybe are not necessarily able to be paid for out of the $15 million, may take some kind of future bond, or those are discussions we want to come to council. As we talked about in the past, right now we're laying out a master plan without the kind of prohibition of kind of a cost containment. Right now we're trying to figure out what could best serve the community as a regional park, with the idea that the Cubs will be here with the stadium and all these activities. Then we'll come back and start working through a programming of what can fit within the current budget and the resources we have, and maybe this gets developed over a period of time. Maybe the initial phase is the grading and the moving of the lake and putting around the walkways, and then the other amenities may come in the future. But that's a conversation.
Do we have any idea how much that would cost?
We have some general broad numbers, but it depends on how much of these amenities are of interest to the community. If we dreamed the dream and added amenities in almost every turn and nook and cranny, which is great, but it may be, maybe it's over programmed, maybe it's something large. So we still need to refine it. Right now it's a number that has a big swag in it, but is it somewhere between 10 and 15 million? We could probably make it work in that area.
The other question, and maybe it's best to leave this for later, but I'll place it now. We have a $50 million budget for offsite improvements or infrastructure.
Streets, parking, and infrastructure.
Correct. And we're using some of that in anticipation of some of the growth. And when we look at this plan, there are some additions to this plan that weren't there a while back. We've seen them for a while, but you have the ASU agreement. They're going to add a field potentially. There's a housing for players that we hadn't anticipated. Plus, at some point, they're going to start to do the commercial development, which we definitely want to see. But all that's going to start to stripping away some of the parking, and we have an obligation for 2,500 spaces. So
the way that's being managed in the agreement, because parking is such a premium, without knowing or without having the experience of parking everyone on the site, today the Cubs have agreed that the option agreement that we talked about for commercial development will be limited to, now at this point, 3 acres east of or west of the Riverview Drive and 3 acres west of, only from the pinpoint of that's commercial, they can take down and purchase that property to as part of the development agreement. If they go beyond that, and if there's an opportunity for development that goes beyond those total of six acres, what it requires is both the city and the Cubs to sit down and say, okay, what impact will this have, or could this, might this have on parking? It doesn't prohibit it. It just puts a con. We believe that the total of 6 acres, 3 acres, 3 acres on either side of Riverview Drive, the city can still meet its obligation to provide the 2,500 parking.
Well, yeah, it's a separate discussion at that point in time.
Right.
We met our 2,500, which anticipates limiting the amount of commercial development in Wrigleyville right. to meet the 2,500. If there is more development that the market will support, then you talk about, okay, the city's provided 2,500 spaces. Now, if you're going to take some of that property away, now we have to talk about who's going to pay for it. And that's now a commercial development. So if the market will support that, the parking will be taken care of, and that will be something that we've already met our obligation on. The commercial development will have to now figure out
right.
how to accommodate their additional
parking. And it may be a joint then at that point.
Yeah.
They come to us and have this great development. We say, well, maybe it's time to go build parking decks. Or, frankly, we've already talked to the developers to the east, and they're very interested in having game day parking in front of the Riverview businesses. So we kind of want to go through those phases and have that opportunity to have that discussion in the future.
We have other maps in this presentation that show the potential commercial development sites here.
Yeah, why don't we move on?
Because
one existed, so go ahead.
Okay, then maybe we could come back to that question of parking. And also on the infrastructure, it's not just parking, it's water, wastewater, all the other amenity traffic. Are we laying the infrastructure in advance of that $3.3 million so that we don't have to necessarily upgrade as what we anticipate the commercial development to be builds out?
Yes, when we put in the water, sewer, gas, electric, it will be sized for what we think is the ultimate build out of the site.
Okay, so we won't have to worry about that later.
We're running short on time here, so let's go on to your next one.
Again, looking east, some of the focal points of the park, the Fishing Cove, play area, a lake festival area, a fountain hub, an adventure play area, and then some iconic features in the park that we think will be important. This is just an idea of a concept we're looking at. Of
spaceship.
It could be a number of things. Of some iconic features to kind of make this a focal point. Again, this is a large piece of property, and trying to make the park that signature piece from many site views from across the highways, the streets, et cetera. Again, just some ideas for
These are ideas. We're throwing
Correct.
Things out. We're trying to dream big, vision right. big, and we'll figure out how to...
Whether
we can afford it later.
Yeah.
Again, this is another potential idea of an iconic feature playing kind of on a treehouse concept out of the steel and integrated with the trees and those type of structures. At the Dobson entrance, as Mr. Brady mentioned, we've thrown all sorts of amenities at every corner of this site as possible. This is kind of that adventure play area, and looking at doing some unique things with bouldering, some high adventure play opportunities, some water play opportunities. You kind of see some ideas at the bottom there of different concepts that we've played with. Again, just concepts, ideas that we're throwing out there. We'll see what kind of reaction we get from the community as we discuss those with them and what other things we may have missed that the community may be interested in. At the 8th Street entrance, again, trying to make sure that water has become an important element to that community. This provides an entryway into the park for residents. You can see the pathways there, the Fishing Cove, the urban edge that we're trying to create for along the walkways there, and that connectivity again to move people throughout this entire site. This is an idea of some walkway concepts, things that would provide shade throughout the day, but could also be an artistic element at night through different lighting and different things to add an interesting flair to the site. Again, just some sketches and rough drafts of bridges and what entryways could look like, what ramadas could look like, trying to play not to the typical design that you usually see in our parks, but trying to add some architectural elements to those to make it more interesting and more inviting. And again, early on, back to that parking area and open space use and focusing on that walkway. It connects, again, all the way through the park from both 8th Street, from Dobson, to help move people through that site. Soccer early on, commercial development opportunities in the future. And again, a potential of what that might look like early on with that parking and some of the different opportunities along that walkway. again, we think the connectivity was an important issue here, and we think eventually this has the opportunity, as I've said a couple of times, the site's a mile long, and this has an opportunity to what we believe become Mesa's Magnificent Mile through these different elements that will be within that mile and the different programming that will take place there. These are some of those potential designs of envisioning what it could look like towards the stadium, towards that urban corridor, with businesses on either side, streets, green play, et cetera, and commercial opportunities there. Again, some of those multi-use areas, the fountain hubs, again, and the fountain area inside of that commercial development potential and how that plays and still continues to connect both the lake across of Riverview Drive all the way through the property. And again, looking west towards the stadium as the site continues to
develop. So this is looking from the park west to the stadium, and we probably need to emphasize more and we'll get some more visuals. The idea is that walkway, Wrigleyville, the Paseo, whatever you want to name it, that's part of the Mesa Magnificent Mile, will have the connector between the park and the stadium, will be a very active, dense urban commercial development. That is the ultimate plan, with development on either side. And so the thought is that right now, and we can go back to another slide that shows the overhead view, but there would be 3 acres of development opportunities, and that actually, where all those cars are parked, you could go back to there, but go to an overview of the whole site.
Okay.
And so when council asks, okay, where's the commercial development going to take place? We don't have the elevations of the corridor, but that corridor, go back to where you were, right? Let me stop there. That where those trees are, that is the area on either side of that main corridor is where we expect to see significant commercial development along there. We show it as parking. We believe that where we're hoping is to see a significant amount of development, and we'll work with the Cubs and kind of creating that concept of that dense development between the stadium and the park so that you have this a commercial experience along the way. And so you can imagine that on either side of that commercial development, both to the north or to the south toward 8th Street, you'd have public parking, but you'd also have parking for the commercial development. And then you'd also probably have some parking on the north side. But that corridor, if you imagine almost like a Kierland, a Santan Village, where you have quite a bit of dense, different type of commercial development along that corridor. And then go to a slide of the park with the two. It shows us an overview of the park again. So there's 3 acres on that side.
This is right there.
There you go. So we were just looking at everything going west of that point where the lake comes up to 8th Street. Now, you notice the way the lake is configured, and this is done on purpose. One, it creates two strong connections from Dobson through the park over to the commercial area. We think it's important to attract and bring people both from the neighborhood as well as from the Riverview development into this property. We expect that a lot of people will park over in Kimco. They've talked about wanting that to happen, but we want to be able to bring them across Dobson and, if needed to, make a very visible and certain pathway that comes from the park through the park and then obviously leading to the stadium. You will notice, though, at the western edge of the park, on the north and south sides of the where those two paths kind of converge, on the north and south end area, you see some pretty significant green spaces. The belief is, as we've talked with the Cubs, is that those would be prime locations for a commercial development, so that they would be facing into the new lake, and so they would have that view going into the lake, and they would have plenty of parking behind them. Again, that parking can be used both for the commercial development, but also for game day. That green space, as it is today at Holcomb Stadium, could be used for game day parking. So that's kind of explains, that gives us about 3 acres on either side of the Riverview Drive for commercial development. It's limited to that for now, just because we're also under the same obligation to provide enough parking for game days, so we're trying to balance that out. But again, we've left the option that if more commercial development wants to, is seeking to come to this site and the Cubs have that development, we just need to sit down and make sure that we've accommodated game day parking in the future. And we really believe that that will happen because we believe that with the overflow at Kimco and the opportunity to bring people across Dobson from the Kimco properties, there'll be enough parking. But parking during game days and getting people in and out is a very important issue. So we've kind of left that to be kind of discussed after we've kind of maybe gone through a couple of games in the season to see kind of what the parking patterns are and how we can manage the traffic flow in this area. So right now it's limited to a total of 6 acres that they have as part of the option agreement that states the value and the time they have to develop it. Doesn't limit them from coming back and saying, hey, we've got some really good interest from some other development. We'd like to explore that. We're open to that idea. We just both realize we then have to sit down and make sure we're addressing the parking demands at the same time.
I'm sorry, the mayor had to step out. So I'll fire off one more question. First of all, you talk about urban development. Is there a residential component to this? Because when you say urban, that usually means some kind of loft or living. Or are we just talking about urban density commercial?
I don't know that we've limited the idea that it couldn't be a mixed-use concept. I think today the discussion has mostly been on commercial retail. But I don't know why we wouldn't be open to the idea if you had commercial and mixed-use with some residential on top. I mean...
So we haven't limited out the idea if it worked.
Again, we want to kind of keep it open. What we want is dense, active commercial development here that will work year-round. That's really what we're looking for.
People-centric.
People-centric. We want a year-round activity. But we also think that space works, that even with the commercial development, that walkway, the paseo between the park, as you come from the park and then go through that paseo leading up to the stadium, it could both have the commercial on the side, and then in the middle, you could have game day kind of temporary uses, gazebos and tents, kind of like a tailgating concept that Cubs are considering. Go back to the overall view of the whole site. The Cubs will be looking at the area south of the stadium will be kind of a large plaza area, and they expect to bring several vendors and have different activities outside of the stadium during game days. And then as you go east from there, we think that as people park on north and south of Paseo, as they come into that Paseo, they'll have other experiences of Wrigleyville experiences, whether they're year-round experiences, which we hope to see evolve, and if not, we think it'll be a great opportunity to have other vendors out there providing a different retail opportunities for patrons of the game. Did we finish? Did you finish?
It. Okay.
And just... Mayor, if I may, just very quickly, we've avoided the discussion of the softball fields. Where are we on that one, and what money pays for that?
Well, right now, the softball fields stay in place.
Right, well, but eventually down the road.
Well, if they move, that means we sold the land. Okay. We sold the land, then we have money to
it may help
to relocate
we're
the softball
use fields. That money. Yeah. Obligated to to put up new softball fields? I believe we are.
Council Richard says we are.
Councilmember Richard says we are.
Well,
city attorney.
Let's put it there's no legal. But when Waveyard came in, I think that the problems.
Yeah, and
Dave,
that.
You can talk about that more. There were certain problems made. Number one, that Riverview Park would be left alone. We're going to break that promise because we're going to make Riverview Park bigger and better.
Right.
We're not. That is a city park. Will stay a city park and will be something spectacular. And we're actually improving on that. The other thing is, I remember. Is that those softball fields would be relocated. And right now we're not going to relocate them, but if we ever sell the land, then we'll have the money to relocate those.
Softball fields, yeah.
The softball fields.
So we're just going to reinvest. That makes sense.
Dave, you want to?
Yeah, I mean, originally there was a pretty strong fixation on replacing softball fields somewhere in West Mesa. What I'm hearing now is there an opportunity to even use the IMESA process to identify what those trade-offs could be. So if we were going to spend, you know, $2 or $3 million on rebuilding softball fields, are there other priorities the community would want met
right.
instead of that?
Right. Well,
for example, youth fields are I'm getting a lot of clamor about youth fields.
So whatever we sell that for, once those
I stepped on you. I'm sorry. Finish up.
It's okay. I'm used to it.
So am I.
A little shoe leather on my forehead. Anyway, so I think at that time we have a conversation with the community, you know, and I think IMESA tees that up well to see what the community priorities are at that time and then seek to fill them instead of becoming overly fixated right. on more adult softball fields when that's not necessarily what we might need.
The key for showing this one to show that they're not being impacted other than the area around the softball fields. We believe it would be a good idea as part of this project, part of our cost in the $15 million to grade out the area around the backside of those softball fields to provide for overflow parking for game day. It's just green grass today, but it's got a lot of berms and things, and that would be a good opportunity. We could get a significant amount of parking back in that area, and so we think that would be a good opportunity as part of the project at the beginning. Okay.
Any other questions? You know, one of the things that we didn't mention in here that maybe Mr. Rigby comes up, but Chris can do, is ASU has not been included in that. Could you explain where ASU is on this? And since it came in late in the game, nothing was mentioned in the development agreement or any of those other things about right. how ASU fits in. So you do see a field up
they've
there.
Added, yeah, they went ahead just to make just sure case, the space would be allocated, yeah. but the cost and how that would be developed. The Cubs are still in negotiations with ASU. The city is also interested in the impact it may have on the city as far as our maintenance requirements for parking. And so those discussions still need to go forward. The agreements are going forward that we're trying to bring to council by the end of this month would not include, we're expecting what we've agreed to the Cubs. It won't include that reference to the ASU baseball team, but it would be something that we could amend shortly thereafter once the agreement's in place. But we just feel like we need to get this project moving forward and get it out there. It doesn't mean that we wouldn't do it, but there are still items that have to be considered. And we wanted to focus on what we have in front of us, get that done. But we do know, and one of the things that when we laid this out, we did have to think about, well, if ASU did come, could we accommodate the additional field in the space? And we do show that that could happen here. But in the agreements you will see, we will not mention that, but it'll be something we would amend later.
Because we haven't yet figured out what those impacts could be.
Right, we still have to set this up.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
you. Okay, the next item on the agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the redistricting map. So if we could have Mr. Scott Higginson. Now, just so we can sort of set the stage for this, and I'd like to first of all commend the redistricting commission. And Scott, if you'd introduce those members who are here, and even those that aren't, so we can thank them for all the work and the effort that they put into this. This is not an easy task, and we really do thank you for all that you've done. We are not taking action on this item today. We are simply here together to receive the report that the Redistricting Commission has voted upon, has approved, and to receive that information and for the council to ask questions, any questions you have of Scott or any of the other commission members. So this is an information gathering. According to the charter, the city council will either act to approve or reject the map that has been presented to us. We plan on doing that because of scheduling and everything, probably at the October 3rd meeting. So that's when we will take formal action. The council will at that time take public input during that meeting, and we will take then formal action on the map that's been presented by the Redistricting Commission. So with that, I'll turn it over to, and the reason we're waiting until October 3rd is because of various commitments and out of town, that's the first meeting that I think we're all going to be here. Otherwise, we have a couple meetings gone. You're going to be gone?
Yeah.
Well,
I might be able to call.
Well, you can call in.
I can call
okay. So we'll work around that, but we want to make sure that we have everyone here if we can, because this is an important enough issue.
Yeah, I can
do that. To make that done. Okay. So I'll turn over to Scott Higginson. Scott?
Thank you, Mayor. I appreciate that. And I have pleased to also recognize, I believe they're all here except for one of our members. Deanna Villanueva Sacito is here. Terry Hines is also here, and Brian Allen, all of whom served with me, along with Nancy Aprosian, who is not able to be here. Let me first of all begin our presentation with many, many thanks to the city staff who assisted us, Carla and Alfred and many others, as well as the consultants from National Demographics Corporation, Doug and Sarah, who made our job a heck of a lot easier than it could have been. The map we have presented to you today is the result of a long process that was filled with hours and hours of discussion, public hearings, and many revisions, versions, and various modifications. Throughout the process, we listened to each other as well as to the input of residents of Mesa and did our best to find a compromise map that takes into account as much of their input as we could while still complying with the requirements and limitations that we operated under. In the end, we had two maps to choose from, which met these requirements. And as you know, the members of the commission did not agree on the final map, but when the final vote was taken, the map that we're presenting to you today received a majority of votes from the commission. Before we get to those maps, which you have, I believe, distributed to you, I thought it was very important for you, as well as members of the public, to understand the significant controlling requirements which dominated our discussions. Perhaps this will help those who might have concerns about one map as opposed to another. There were three significant controlling requirements which dominated our discussions. Number one was, as required by Arizona law and based upon the 2010 census, we were required to use existing census blocks as our defining geographical boundaries or units. The new districts that are created have to be within equal population, and I emphasize population. It's not registered voters, it's simply population, of within 1 or 2%, and that's a requirement of state law. The target number for each district then became just over 73,000 citizens. So for only 1% deviation, that's only about 730 people. So the lines had to be fairly precise and fairly exact, and this is a requirement. Secondly, as you are aware, the Mesa City Charter contains a provision requiring that during the redistricting process, which must occur every 10 years, current sitting members of the City Council must remain in their districts when the new maps and boundaries are drawn. This, too, is a requirement that we could not deviate from. The third and final requirement under the Federal Voting Rights Act was to maintain the current levels of Hispanic voting age population, or as we lovingly became familiar with it, HVAP, at 54.4% or above, and to maintain the Hispanic citizen voting age population at 25.4% or above in District 4. Both of these numbers needed to be met. Any level of reduction would be considered what is called retrogression by the Federal Department of Justice, who will be reviewing and approving this final map. This, too, is a requirement. So those three things really dominated much of our discussion. In our discussions, after my presentation, I'd be happy to discuss any of these requirements in greater detail if necessary. That's just the kind of the surface explanation of those requirements, but they truly were dominating factors. As a result of these requirements, the Commission immediately saw, then, the need to begin our process with District 4, since it had the requirements placed upon it from the Department of Justice. Its current population today is only 58,817, according to the 2010 census, which parenthetically is less than it was 10 years ago. The smallest of all six districts. And so, as you can see, District 4 needed to add over 15,000 residents to its boundary just to maintain the requirement of it having equal population. This needed to be done while doing so, maintain the current percentage levels of HVAP and HCVAP in order to avoid retrogression. The commission, with the help of the consultant, started first then with District 4. And this requirement. We began looking at areas surrounding District 4 and individual census blocks bordering existing District 4 that had the highest level of Latino residents. And believe me, we blew them up on that big screen behind the mayor's head, and we looked at them block by block, individual census blocks, to look at those that had the highest Latino population. If District 4 was going to grow and maintain appropriate levels under the Voting Rights Act, we had to add those areas first, and so we did, block by block. By doing so, what we discovered was that District 4, in many ways, ended up defining itself. By so doing, there we found that there was not a lot of wiggle room when it came to District 4. By adding the bordering census blocks from Districts 1, 2, and 3, the only ones that are adjacent to it, with the highest levels of Latino population, we had, for all intents, cemented District 4's boundary, as there was not much additional area with high levels of Latino population that could be added to reach the necessary population requirements and avoid retrogression. District 4 became self-defining. That's why in the four maps that were brought to you before, A, B, C, and D, which were presented to the council during a previous study session, and which were used during part of the public or during part of the public process, District 4 was nearly the same in every single map. Its boundaries were pretty well set from there. And from there, it really was a matter of determining the boundaries of Districts 1, 2, and 3, which surround District 4. The analogy that I used in many of our hearings was much like the old-style washing machine, where you have the dial, and you got the permanent press cycle, and you got the other type of cycles, and you kind of spin that dial around and line up the one you want. That was Districts 1, 2, and 3 surrounding 4. And we had to look at, well, where do we take this district up and around this way or that way, and how does it then change all those districts as they revolve around District 4? So then, once District 4 was set, and since the districts which were overpopulated lie in the eastern half of the city, our next step was to begin with District 3 in the west and begin adjusting all boundaries of the districts eastward. Districts 5 and 6 were those that were left to ensure that an equal balance of population remained between those two districts once we had completed the work on 4 and then 1, 2, and 3 in that order. Much of the growth of District 4, recognizing the population movement, came from District 3. So if District 4 in the center had to grow, it grew into District 3, which now has made District 3, which was behind in population already, the requirement to grow even more. It had only two ways to go, east or north, because it represents the southwest corner of the city limits. We presented to the council and the public four maps, as I mentioned earlier, each of those showing various alternatives of how the expansion of District 3 could occur. And through that process, we, the commission, narrowed it down to two alternatives, Plan A and Plan B. Plan A maintained District 3's eastern boundary with District 4 to demonstrate how far north District 3 would need to grow in order to meet the other requirements. We turned the dial as far as we could to the north to see how far up into the north it would have to grow if we left the eastern boundary where it was. That was Plan A. Plan B maintained District 3's northern boundary with District 1 to demonstrate how far east District 3 would need to grow in order to meet our other requirements. Each plan was purposefully drawn in this fashion to show the extremes of either direction in order to solicit opinion and input from the public. As you can imagine, there were those, both in the public and on the commission, who opposed each extreme. In our discussions during our final two meetings following the six public hearings, the extremes were reviewed, and a compromise map, which you have a plan today before you called Plan B Modified, was presented. One of the members of the commission still wanted to try avoid expanding District 3 to the east.
Hey, Scott.
Yes?
Just very quickly. I think on our maps it's called Plan 9 Modified.
No, it's Plan 3. You should have a Plan B Modified.
Oh, excuse me. I'm looking at this thing.
You'll need the others as well.
There we go. This is the one that you... Okay, we got you.
Plan B Modified was presented... And one of the members, as I said, wanted to try to avoid expanding District 3 to the east in any fashion, while also avoiding going up and over District 1 as we had done in Plan A. We all hoped for that, and we worked on it for some time, But in our most lengthy meeting that we held, we could not define a map that did so and met all of the requirements. So we adjourned, and the consultant agreed to work with this commission member in trying to develop a map that lessened the expansion of District 4 into District 3 and therefore precluded the need to expand District 3 to the east as severely to the north. When we met again, we were hopeful of this effort's success, and this is a map you have before us, because a map that you have before you, labeled Plan 9 Modified, was presented to us. It seemed to meet the requirements and goals of following major streets and landmarks. However, we learned from our consultants that while Plan 9 Modified met the population requirement and kept all existing members of the council in their respective districts, it did not meet the requirements of the Federal Voting Rights Act, as HVAP and HCVAP numbers were less than currently existed in District 4. So in short, in order to meet the population requirements, it took too many of the higher Latino population census tracts and blocks from District 3 and had moved them back into 4. So Plan 9 Modified, while it looked like it met the things that we were seeking, it did not meet the HVAP numbers. We pursued a line of questioning with the consultants that evening about what type of reaction the Department of Justice would have to Plan 9 Modified. Again, because as a commission, we felt it looked had a good look to it. It seemed to meet all the other requirements. So we wondered, what would the Department of Justice's reaction be to Plan 9 Modified that didn't meet the HVAP numbers? We were told that this map would clearly generate their engagement and denial of the map, which in turn would require additional hearings and costs to the city. Hearing this, the commission, none of the members, were inclined to take action on Plan 9 Modified. So we then spent an additional period of time moving District 4 census blocks, going block by block to see where it had originally been, and leaving the eastern boundary of District 4 where it was, and at the same time adding census block by census block to the north end of District 3 to see where it would need to end up in order to meet the population requirements. The final product of that exercise is the effort that you have, and that effort is what you have before you, labeled Plan 9 Modified 2. So, Plan 9 Modified 2 reflects the best effort of the commission, and you have those before you, and I think they're coming up on the screen. Plan 9 Modified 2 reflects the best effort of the commission to maintain the eastern boundary of District 3 with 4 and add population to District 3 from District 1 while keeping the existing council member in their district. At that point, we had some discussion between Plan 9 Modified 2 and Plan B Modified. I emphasize that those were the only two plans we were voting on. Plan 9 Modified did not meet HVAP requirements, and so we dismissed it. But I wanted you to see it today so you knew kind of where we had come from. After some discussion and a clear airing of the views of all members, a motion was made to approve Plan B Modified. And it passed and is the plan the commission recommends to you today. This plan is a compromise of sorts, as it allows District 3 to expand a bit to the north and a bit to the east as well. It is neither extreme, and it meets all of the requirement of federal state law as well as those of the Mesa City Charter. I would also point out that it takes into consideration several of the concerns raised by members of the council in our previous study session with you, as well as some of those received from the public during our hearing process. There are several of those that I point out quickly. The southeast corner of District 4 remains within District 4, as we had heard concerns from the public regarding that issue. Superstition Springs area, Vice Mayor Summers, I think we got that fixed to where the Superstition Springs area remains in District 6. Okay. And the area between the two county islands is contained within only one district rather than being split. Now, Commission Member Nancy Aprosian was not able to be here today. She forwarded a statement to the city manager and the city attorney's office, which she asked that I read for the record today, if I could, Mayor Smith, in conclusion.
Go right ahead. Well, you want to ask questions first and then... Well, why don't you go ahead and read the statement, and then we'll...
Nancy writes this: I supported the map that we present to the City Council for many reasons. This map took into account the public comments from those residents that live in District 4. the citizens' response to keep the Mesa High area as intact as possible. Since District 4 cannot move east, I believe that this map allows for this community of interest to stay together. If we were to choose the other map, it would totally disregard public input from those residents from District 4 who participated and those residents who submitted maps that met those requirements. Most of the maps that were submitted by residents that were in or near compliance with the requirements we had to consider mirrored the approach to take District 3 to include the U.S. baseline corridor. I was really impressed with the thought and detail of the letter of Mr. Augie Gostium, hope I'm not butchering that too bad, who submitted with his map that explained how and why he drew the map. It took into consideration that each council district have something unique in their own district. This map allows each district to maintain the core of their shape and have a unique feature that highlights that council district. For District 1, that is Riverview. District 2, Superstition Springs Mall District. District 3, Fiesta Mall, the Fiesta District, and Mesa Community College. District 4 has the Downtown District and Mesa Arts Center. District 5 has Falcon Field and the Red Mountain Campus of MCC. District 6 has the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport, ASU Polytechnic Campus. That is why my vote was cast as a supportive yes of this map, and without confusion, she writes. Again, I thank the members of the council and the mayor for the opportunity to work on this important matter. I again thank the city staff and other members of the commission who we worked together. I look forward to responding to your questions and or those raised by others that you may have received as part of this process.
Let me offer up one thing. There's other members of the commission here, and since we read something in from Nancy, I don't know if Deanna or Ms. Hines or saw Brian Allen here earlier would like to add anything or say anything right now. Deanna, would you like to come on up here? You want to take a couple, 3 minutes?
Mayor and Council, thank you for your time today. I'd like to reiterate that it was spirited discussion during the course of this planning process, and that's to put it mildly. I think that the plan that was forwarded to you was not unanimous. Well, obviously, it was not unanimous. I think as much as some people think that this is a good compromise and doesn't go to the extreme, there's still, I think, a large portion of residents that we've heard from that do feel that this is extreme, and I want to make sure that that goes on the record. So this by no means is any kind of complete compromise. I think it is one option that was put on the table, and it's the one that won the highest votes. But I want to be very clear that this is certainly not a unanimous decision, and that there still is a number of residents that feel that this is just as extreme as other maps that were put forward. So I just want to make that clear.
Let me ask you something, because is there any compromise that would not have been viewed as extreme by one group or another?
I think the Plan 9 that did not meet the Hispanic voting age requirement, population requirement, was probably a good compromise because it doesn't go too far to the north in terms of District 1. Neither does it go too far in the east, at least from the residents that I heard from. As a Hispanic resident of District 4, I'd be willing to take on DOJ and express my opinion, but, you know, they probably have a little bit more clout than I am, but... That's what we heard from.
Okay.
I think it comes down to a real philosophical disagreement on growth patterns and future growth patterns, and that's not something that's easily compromised on.
Vice Mayor?
When you're ready.
Oh, okay. Signs? You want to say anything, or is Brian still here? Oh, Brian.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Deanna.
Hi, good afternoon. My position on this map that we've adopted is more about my concern about communities of interest. And while I understand within a district there can be a number of communities of interest and they don't have to all be the same, when you look at West Mesa and you go south to north, you just have a lot of communities of interest that are just much more similar. And so my preference was to try to find a way to maintain that community of interest and just all of West Mesa north to south. And that was pretty much my objection, along with the fact that it just feels like such a cheat to me that we take that baseline Superstition corridor and in 5-6 miles there's, I think, 175 residents. So it's such a stretch to go over that zero population area almost just to grab enough people so that we say we have equal population. So that was my position.
Thank you. Brian Allen.
And not to beat a dead horse of what we've already discussed, but I'll just give you my view, and that is we heard the strongest from two community groups who had exactly opposite ideas. One community group felt most strongly in favor of Plan A, and one felt most strongly in favor of Plan B. And so our effort was to try to figure out a way to reach a compromise, and the problem was the compromise map that we reached faced DOJ problems. And when we talked with our consultant about it, even a 1 or 1.5% retrogression number, in his opinion, was significant. And without something on the record to justify the reduction, that would be a problem. And number two, one of the things that would be looked at is, was there an alternative that didn't have retrogression problems? And we did have an alternative. It's not the prettiest of alternatives, and we will readily admit that if we could have driven if we could have drawn the boundaries in a more geographically compact manner, we would have. But when we were left with Plan B modified and Plan 9 modified 2, my opinion was that Plan 9 modified 2 caused more disturbance to the communities of interest in Northwest Mesa than did Plan B modified. And so that was the reason why, of the two choices that were difficult, the one that we have presented to the council is the one that serves the interest better, avoids potential problems and litigation with the Department of Justice, and meets the requirements and the marching orders we were given, which were difficult given the city charter and the Department of Justice requirements. So that's where I came from on that decision.
Thank you, Brian. Okay. Vice Mayor, I think you had a question.
A couple things, Scott. First of all, let me commend you in the and the incredible work that you and the entire committee did. This is not easy. And the fact that you came up with two viable solutions that, I mean, they have components that we don't like about each, but they are viable solutions. You're to be commended for that. Superstition Springs, two quick questions. Superstition Springs being one. In the plan that was approved, modified, be modified, it's still missing a small portion of it north of Southern. Were you not able to include that into District 6?
From my memory from our conversations, that was a small apartment area, and we felt more strongly to keep the Southern as a significant boundary between the two districts than to try and maneuver around an apartment area. If I'm mistaken, we
yeah, it was. It's not apartments. There are two housing neighborhoods between 72nd and Sossaman south of Euclid, essentially, would be the alignment. A number of houses in there.
Southern was such a strong boundary that we...
I understand. The second question, maybe you can answer. One of the things that these maps do compared to the original map is it confuses the county island area somewhat if we are to start annexing some of that area in. Under the original map, it was pretty easy to look at it and say, this is going to be District 5, this is going to be District 6. When you look at either one of these options, let's go with B modified because that was the example, particularly over, say, around Crisman Road, you have District 6 pops up north, District 5 pops down, and it's not really intuitive of which area they would be annexing into. Was that something you're tasked to do, or is that something the council is going to have to look at and say that if you are south or east of this line, you're in 6, if you're in 5? Sunland, it looks like Leisure World in the area north could be 2, or could be 6, or could be 5. So how do we address that? Do we have to address that to the DOD, or is that something that the council could make a policy on?
That's something that you could review in the future, because those population, those county islands are not in the city. We didn't even look at them.
Okay.
We don't even know what their population is. We don't know what their numbers are.
I mean, we've been annexing in lot by lot and little things over the last 10 years, and those weren't in any district either.
No, that's true, but when you look at the old map, Main Street was clearly the dividing line, and so anything south of Main became District 6, anything north became District 5. This muddles a little bit. I mean, clearly your committee doesn't have anything to do with that, so that's something that the council may have to deal with. My suggestion would be I make a motion that it all become District 2, but I don't know that that'll pass.
Well, here's the issue we have. Let me explain, and maybe Debbie can explain. Per the charter, and Debbie, you want to explain what the council's obligation and how the process will work, so that as we go through these questions, and I want to make sure we let everyone know, we have been presented with a redistricting commission map. We have, as I understand it, a vote to either accept the map or to reject the map. If we reject the map, I'm certain we can include suggestions, but at that point in time, if we reject the map, it goes back to the commission, and we are then out of the process. Because according to the charter, the redistricting commission then makes the final decision, and that becomes the map, without further action from the council. Mm. So we can't partially accept and partially reject. We either accept it as presented or reject it with or without comments. Now, Debbie, if you want
to... No, that's correct, Mayor. And that question will come to the council probably the first meeting in October. Today, it's just to receive the information and if you have questions.
Okay. But the question on the county islands isn't something for the commission. It's something for us to decide. I'm just saying that we probably need to discuss that at some point, that this is an issue that's being raised because of redistricting. I'm not suggesting that we send it back to the commission to change, which we can't do anyway.
And I don't think you answered that question today either, but let me ask Alfred. He's been handling this project for us.
Councilmember Summers, that's correct. We would have to wait until ultimately at some point in time when we decide to annex that, because we are, as populations are coming in and the changes occur every 10 years, we are, our population deviations will change as we get new residents in it. So we would have to make that determination at that time as to what district we would want those individuals to reside in, and then come 2021, when we go through this process again, we would then be able to adjust the maps in order to, again, make sure that our minority population is still within the retrogression.
That's an interesting process. I mean, John just popped a couple of Excedrin over here because he's going to be trying to figure out which district they're going to be.
You may, as you made reference to earlier, Vice Mayor, have to enact the policy of the council that, whereas it used to be kind of a rule of thumb, anything north and east or north and south of Maine, you may have to move that now to southern, north on Ellsworth, and then across to Maine, and wherever they fall with that kind of a dotted line boundary, that's the district they fall in.
Okay. Councilmember Cavanaugh.
And this being my third districting I've gone through, I applied the work for the commission and the consultants and the staff. It's a very difficult job. I attended the meeting in my district, which was quite well attended. And the chair was there, and there were a lot of comments. And with regard to the plan B modified, I know there's a lot of concern from residents of my district over that proposal to extend south of the freeway corridor over to Lindsay Road. And while from a property standpoint, obviously there's contiguity, we do have a fair number of miles in which no people live. With the way the development exists today and the zoning exists today, there will be no future residential development in that area. So there will never be, or hardly likely to ever be, people moving into that area between Country Club and Gilbert Road. And so I guess my concern is, it while it's physically contiguous, it's really almost fictionally contiguous in terms of people or in terms of communities of interest. Because we look to communities of interest, we look to where do people go to the high school boundaries, as was mentioned earlier, the junior high schools, the schools, the shopping centers, the church congregations where people go to. Those are some of the key points or elements that we can look at to try to identify communities of interest. How would you harmonize a community of interest from a neighborhood that is so physically far removed that will really never be connected by other neighborhoods to the western part of District 3?
I can tell you my own feelings, and I'm sure other members of the commission might have their own. That 2.5 mile stretch where there's only 174 people is a little longer than the stretch across the Riverview area, which is also a zero population area, that in order to add the area from Plan 9 Modified 2 into District 3, we also had to cross a large expanse of a zero population area in order to pick up population. I raised in one of our meetings, Councilman Kavanaugh, that perhaps we ought to have the most extreme map that does extend as far east as possible be the one that we recommend, because then it would have a larger constituent of people living on that eastern arm of the district to generate a community of interest. But there was opposition to that. And so in trying to find a middle ground modified plan, that's where we then picked up just the area between Gilbert and Lindsay. The original map went all the way to Val Vista, one of the maps. And that would have generated more bodies out there, more population that could have been defined, I guess, as a community of interest. But I think the point that at least a majority of us felt was that, and Deanna made reference to this earlier, that communities of interest does not mean that all the district has to be homogenous in its nature. It is that there are communities of interest within the district, and each district may have 4 or 5 communities of interest. And in our public hearings that were held in both District 3 and District 1, many of the residents, as you know, you and I were both there in District 3, who were opposed to a plan along the lines of Plan B Modified, did not live in the area that was being added in. Whereas in the council, in the meeting that was held in District 1, the majority of the people who showed up opposed to that plan that went up and over lived in that area. And so to me, that was a strong deciding factor, that the people who were opposed to us going to the east didn't live in the east. They weren't opposed to it. They just made comments like, well, we feel more similarity to the people along the west. We feel closer to them, even though geographically it's not closer, it's further. Whereas in the meeting, those individuals living in District 1 who would have been moved into District 3, they were the ones who spoke out in opposition to that plan that went up and over in order to capture them. And that, for me, was the deciding factor. That the individuals who were opposed to it were the ones who were being impacted when it came to that plan. The individuals who were opposed to Plan B Modified weren't being impacted by it at all.
Yeah, and certainly I reviewed the comments from District 1, and many of the comments expressed a concern of trying to keep the Mesa Grande Community Alliance in one district, when in fact right now the Mesa Grande Community Alliance encompasses 3 districts. You know,
and we discovered that in our hearing process, Councilman, and kind of discounted that argument as far as that right. area.
Because that was part of the majority, at least, of the comments that right. were received on that. The other concern I have, though, is that certainly the area between Gilbert and Lindsay could be considered a community of interest. But I guess the challenge that I see for the city is it's a remote community of interest from the rest of the district. And so I think that's where at least many of the comments that I have heard is that there will never be infill of people between the two areas of interest. And so how do you really create a district that has a sense of unity or of purpose as you do in some of the other areas? And again, that's just some of the questions and concerns.
I understand. And we heard them, and I would just point out, if I could real quickly, Mayor, that in Plan 9 Modified 2, that little area up and above District 1 would also be remote. Because it goes through a large area of unpopulated in order to reach it as well. They would both have remote areas.
Well, Scott, if I could, because I'm interested in what you said. How many people who live between Gilbert and Lindsay showed up to oppose District 3?
I heard from none who lived in that area.
Okay, so, and that's what I thought I heard. I just wanted to clarify that. Okay, so, but what you're saying is that on the other one that you were looking at, the bird's beak or whatever it looks like, funky,
Plan 9
Modified
2.
You had a lot of people up in that area, which wherever that area is.
Yeah, there were significant representatives of that area who were opposed to any plan that went up and over. And again, okay, this is not an exact replica of Plan 9. We tried our best to keep to work from the original one that was brought to us of Plan 9 modified. It actually had a larger area up and above in the plan that went out to the public, and their reaction of opposition was to that going up and over District 1. In fact, this one, as I said, is even a little more onerous in that the council member from District 1, I think somebody said he wouldn't have to get to know his neighbors very well because it's kind of that little isthmus that he would be residing on. But it does wrap both under and over that district more so than it did in the past.
Okay, thank you. Councilman Richens.
It's funny because I already know all of those neighbors pretty well.
I'm sure you do,
Councilman. Hopping mad to gain representation that they don't know. And I don't think Mesa Grande ever wanted to keep in one council district because I was part of the people who drew the original boundaries for Mesa Grande, and the whole reason we drew the boundaries into three council districts was strategically to work with three votes out of four, because right, we knew four votes won, just like right, three votes wins on this commission.
Yeah, that's four an argument we hear all the time.
So, I mean, Mesa Grande, that wasn't the intent of Mesa Grande to do that. But, you know, the same thing that, you know, not only is the Riverview area a big expanse to connect, and I agree with Dennis that this area to the south is a long area to connect out there. That thing already occurs at Main Street to Broadway, Elm School to Dobson. There's nobody that lives in there, and that's how it's drawn today. You have huge industrial areas that separate his district currently and take in and split Westwood High School boundaries are in his district. Dobson High School boundaries are in his district. I think part of Mesa High School boundaries are in his district. I have Mountain View and Westwood in my district. Right. I mean, that happens. So keeping high school boundaries intact, to me, isn't as big a deal as certain neighborhoods. You know, one of the arguments that's been put forth here is that stretching out all the way over here, for District 3, which none of the residents seem to oppose, was somehow not fair to the process, not fair to those residents. They'd be disconnected. But I don't understand why coming up over the top of my district is okay. If that's not okay, then, you know, if Plan B modified okay, Plan 9 modified too is just as bad for the same reason. And, you know, so we're arguing two sides of the same reason. I think you guys really had big challenges based on the charter requirement of where we all live. I've lived in that house 12 years. I've been there before this charter requirement was written, redistricting. I ain't moving. I like my neighborhood. My kids like their schools. You know, and I feel bad that is one of the requirements. I mean, you know, it would really make sense for, you know, District 3 to come and have a consistent portion of that. But being that that's not the case, we shouldn't sacrifice the rest of the neighborhoods in the process. So I really think Plan B modified has been a good compromise, particularly looking at, you know, how those communities have interacted in Mesa over the years. Mesa has grown east to west, not north to south. My neighborhood was built in the 60s. Dobson Ranch was built when, Dennis?
70s.
In the 70s. You know, Dobson Ranch has much less to do with my neighborhood. My neighborhood shopped in downtown when downtown was in its heyday. Dobson Ranch folks have always shopped at Fiesta Mall. There hasn't been that connection. So there's, you know, those connections don't really exist. They're very loose affiliations. And, you know, but as the city's grown, I think those neighborhoods in Gilbert and Lindsay were built out probably in the late 70s, maybe early 80s. So there's, you know, either way, it's going to be difficult. I think a good compromise was struck here, and I appreciate you guys working to strike that compromise. And there's no real easy way that you're going to get 5-0 and 7-0 votes on this one. I didn't think so from the very beginning, but I appreciate the time that everyone took to get to where we are.
Thank you.
Councilmember Higgins.
Thank you, Mayor. I wondered could you ever get to a compromise? I'm looking at all the committee members. If you had a little more time to tweak the squares.
We really did try, and I'll let others speak if they wish, but we spent it's almost an hour and a half, I know, at least, taking Plan 9 modified to get us to Plan 9 modified 2, literally looking at every census tract that had a high level of Latino population, moving it back into four, and then saying, okay, we just lost 1,000 people. How do we find 1,000 people to the north? And it was a very, you know, back and forth chess match, moving this one over, now where do we got to go? Move this over, now where do we have to go? As I said in my presentation, District 4 pretty well defined itself just by what we had to do with population and Latino population.
No, and I say that because, you know, in all three cases, the District 1, 5, 2 interface are almost identical. So I know that there's not a lot of large Hispanic population there. However, you know, 2 can absorb, so can 1 as, you know, you move that kind of stuff. So when I look at this and, oh, no, it's the final thing, and yet Plan 9 modified going up over the top, that's ridiculous as, for me, Plan B modified going across the bottom, although it's a little sillier because we're cutting out your house, you know, so that's silly. But, and I'll say, my dot's on the line there. I've been there 17 years. I don't plan on moving either. But
we knew very early in this process that Val Vista was a hard boundary for whatever we were doing.
But, you know, that just, you know, when I see three maps where you say, you know, we've done it all, we tried really hard, I'm thinking, well, you know, I think there's, I mean, those three, that interface, you know, there's still population that can be moved through there. Where Councilmember Finter lives is safe and moving the boundaries. So I just wondered, you know, if you had another couple of meetings with a couple more hours, could you make it work?
Well, that's sort of a moot point because we have a recommendation from the commission.
Could of. How's that? Yeah, I just want to know. Could it have?
Would I have appreciated more time? Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I think we all would have. And I think that you're finding that at the state level. You're finding that everywhere they come, that there are always ways to re-look at the data, re-look at that. But we have a time frame that we have to live within, and at some point in time you got to say,
and what
we're there.
Tell me when does it have to be filed? Probably Ms. Crocker knows for election stuff, right?
We were talking about, I'm sorry, go ahead.
The county wants everything by October 1, but we have a little bit of leeway on that since I know a few of the council members are out on the 26th.
Okay. Yeah, right now I know they're talking about at the state level, that they're worried about getting it in, which means that this election, as what happened last time, would either be that it'll end up in the courts. And if it then ends up in the courts, then you have the courts drawing the lines because they didn't meet the deadlines.
If I could respond to Councilmember Higgins' question, we literally went down the eastern boundary of 4 to exactly what you were saying. Is there any way we can fudge this, move this a little bit further to the east and maintain the Latino population numbers, and they just were not there. And I think you all have a census tract map that was delivered to you. You can look at that if you'd like to yourselves.
We need to wrap this up. Councilmember Richens,
I'm trying to think of how many different maps I've seen. We started with 4, and then we ended up with 4 more, and then we had 10 or 11 or 12 plans submitted from the public. How many?
10.
And then we have 3 more of these. I mean, I think that just about every conceivable shape has been drawn. You know, I don't know that tinkering, I mean, all you would do is give people another month to argue. I'm not seeing more tinkering.
I just think, you know, this council selected 5 citizens that are high quality, great volunteers, really sharp. And I thought we would have a 5-0 recommendation because I was expecting 5-0. So when I don't see 5-0, I'm like, oh, well, could they have worked a little longer to get 5-0? So that's my whole thing.
I can assure you, if Plan 9 modified had met the Hispanic population, it would have been passed.
Which, for most parts, would have been okay, except for I think Plan 9 has one major flaw in it, but that's okay. Since we're here to accept, and I want to thank you because this is yeoman's work. I know you all took it very seriously. You listen to people, and as Deanna said, you know, the fact of the matter is that people are very passionate about this thing, and that they're, because of the requirements we have, you are not going to end up with nicely compact districts. That's just the way it was, and that's the hand we've been dealt. Even with the, you know, we're getting all upset about the one little gyration. My guess is that if you went into any other community, go into Phoenix and see how their maps come out, this will look like square blocks compared to what other communities are. I mean, I've looked at the districts Phoenix has right now, and they go every which way and up around. Ahwatukee's with the Biltmore area. Yeah, that's two, really, you know, those two have a lot in common, don't they? And so I commend you for working within the limitations you had and the instructions you had. I think you've done a great job. I really do. I think you're right. When District 4 is self-defining, you really are looking at how do we rotate 1 and 3, and that really what it come down to. And I get that people are going to feel very strongly on both sides of that. I also think that either way you do it, some of the arguments about having industrial you're going to cross, you can't avoid that.
Right.
Because if you go north, you already have an industrial area that's half a mile or more wide and about 3 miles long that you already cross. If you throw Riverview, and I have very strong feelings about that because I believe it's important that two things. Number one, every district, and it was pointed out in the letter, every district has something of significance. And I think one of the things that's important is that the districts, as best they can, have something, especially a commercial area. If we were to take Riverview out of one basically becomes a purely residential area because there's no other area of commercial significance in District 1. And I think that's a problem, especially, which is my second point, and I commend you for trying to maintain as much as you could existing. I think that's important, continuity and doing as much you can. You can't avoid the weirdities in many ways. You're going to have people shift. I think it was really interesting what you said and compelling. I did not realize that the people between Gilbert and Lindsay, I don't know, I can't make a final judgment. I don't know what they were thinking, but it seemed interested that they did not participate, whereas the people up north were very interested and took an interest. And I think the reason is because they've been together for a long time. They define a community interest because they've worked on issues that are the same, and I think Riverview is one of those issues that has historically been a District 1 type issue, and those people have played a big role. And I would have a real problem if Riverview were taken out of District 1 simply because I think that fits. And, you know, District 3, Dennis has the Fiesta area, which, you know, we're all excited about, and it's going to take a lot of work. District 4 is the downtown. 2 has Dana Park and other things. 6 has the Gateway. 5 has the Falcon. I think you've done a great job, and I appreciate the fact that there is not a simple nor a universally accepted solution. There never is in redistricting. And this is one of those where nobody's right or wrong. You just do the best you can, and you guys did a great job, and thank you so very much.
Thank you, Mayor. We appreciate that.
Really appreciate that. Okay, so once again, this will be on the agenda on October 3rd. At that point in time, we'll take public input during, because it'll be a normal agenda item, and we will then decide whether to accept this or whether to reject this plan. Okay? So, Debbie, is that an accurate description?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Mayor Smith.
The reason I wanted to get done is we do have one item, and this was a pre-scheduled public opinion appearance from Mr. Michael Stevens. And I want to make sure Mr. Stevens, since he is on the agenda, has his opportunity to speak. Mr. Stevens, you here? Okay, well, I guess Mr. Stevens didn't come. All righty. With that, Mr. Brady.
Just a few other items for calendaring. This Wednesday, September 14th, we have a Public Safety Committee meeting that begins at 7:30 here in the lower level council chambers. We will have a study session this Thursday, September 15th, beginning at 7:30. And that'll be followed by a community and cultural development committee meeting. And then also that same evening on September 15th, we have a District 2 Building Strong Neighborhoods event beginning at 6:30 at Taylor Junior High. And as the mayor just mentioned, we have our second council meeting in September, our second council meeting in September will be September 26th. That'll be the next council meeting. And then then following that, on October 3rd, will be the first council meeting in October. So you have tonight's council meeting, September 26th city council meeting, and October 3rd city council meeting.
No study session last week of September?
Yeah. What did I say? Yes. No, I'm sorry. We would have a 29th. Study session on the
29th.
Ninth.
Okay. I skipped over one item on the agenda, item 3, to acknowledge receipts of minutes and various boards. Have a motion from the Vice Mayor, second from Councilmember Higgins. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Okay.
We're going to not have the executive session, and therefore we have a motion to adjourn from Vice Mayor Sutton and Councilmember Kavanaugh. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We're adjourned. Thank you so very much. It was a long meeting, but really appreciate everybody.